This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. More than 200,000 Americans are diagnosed with prostate cancer each year, and about 29,000 die from it. In North Carolina, the odds of dying from prostate cancer are among the highest in the nation. The odds are worse for African Americans. In this state, African Americans are nearly two times as likely as whites to be diagnosed with prostate cancer and nearly three times as likely to die from its complications. WUNC reporter and former News and Observer correspondent Jay Price took a look into the epidemic for a series in the newspaper. It is called The Silent Killer. Jay Price joins us now. Welcome, Jay.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be here.
Give us a sense of the scope of just generally prostate cancer in North Carolina. How widespread is it?
Well, as you said, it's about twice as common, nearly twice as common as it is among whites. But in some of the counties, the mortality rate approaches or exceeds five times that for white males. And, you know, it's not just a matter of like how widespread it is, it's how hard it's hitting, particularly in counties that are majority black, which includes a large swath across the north and down into the east. But the numbers are high regardless of population, you know, the size of the population. If you take it as a percentage of the population, that's where that up to five times comes from.
What are the regions that are hardest hit?
We've got maps up at newsobserver.com. The entire series is up in this kind of magazine format, and there are these really, really stark maps that kind of lay it out. You'll see that there really aren't numbers in the West at all, in part because many of the counties have very low populations of African Americans generally. But really a swath starting in the Triangle and kind of looping up across the North, down into Bertie, Northampton, and then down across the face of the eastern side of the state is really where the problem is worse.
All right. And as you said, it is worse here in North Carolina than the rest of the country. But the story for African-American men all across the country is worse generally. Is that right?
Yeah. It's pretty bad. But, you know, again, it shows up in maps. If you look at national maps, there's a swath of mainly southern and southeastern states where it's particularly bad. And, of course, there are states that have really low African-American populations, too, which kind of helps hide the fact that it's a national problem.
And, again, what is remarkable and in many ways disturbing about all of this is that while the incidence is much higher, the mortality rate is even higher still. In other words, more African-American men are dying from this even as more are being diagnosed. Is that true also nationally?
Yeah. And the reasons for it, many of them are not well known. Some are pretty clear, some aren't. The kind of usual things that drag down public health, diet, exercise issues, that sort of thing, come into play for sure. And in this case, there are also access issues. If you think about someone who doesn't have health insurance or can't afford health insurance, and in the case of some of our rural counties, doesn't really have access to high-quality health providers because they just simply aren't there. They're pretty thin on the ground in the Northeast in many counties. Then you've got someone who might be diagnosed late when the disease has already gone pretty far and is much more difficult to rein in.
All right. Access is something you can't control, but resistance is something else that you report, resistance to testing and to treatment. Tell us about what you found there.
Well, there have been a lot of studies of this particular thing, and in North Carolina, UNC in particular put a lot of time and effort into this a few years back, working with the University down in Louisiana. They studied the black populations here and there, trying to get a better sense of a lot of things about this gap. They'd learned some things, were unable to figure out other things, but they were looking at things like diet. One of the things that was pretty clear was a reluctance to engage with the white-dominated medical establishment. And, you know, there are a host of reasons for that, and some of them are kind of generational. Some go all the way back to the Tuskegee scandal that began in the 30s, a series of essentially experiments where about 600 black sharecroppers were enrolled to study syphilis. 400 of them had the illness, and the rest didn't, and it was allowed to progress without being checked even once a cure for it was found. And that, of course, didn't make people likely to want to go if they're African-American, like to go and connect with not just the medical establishment, but the research establishment, which has led to a number of gaps in what we know about the disease in black men.
Well, and for all of us, because there was so much controversy and actually confusion around testing, the standard blood test, the PSA test, a lot of controversy and confusion around that in all communities. Does that contribute to this? And maybe you can talk about some of the confusion as well.
Yeah, I think one of your guests who'll be on later is a real expert on this. He was kind of in the midst of a hot spot of this controversy. But in 2011, an organization, a panel called the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, announced the new guidelines that they were thinking about and that they instituted the next year for prostate cancer screening, a test called the PSA test, which measures a substance in the blood that comes from the prostate. And the test has long been used to try to figure out if someone has prostate cancer or not. It has, however, proven extremely unreliable. It is far from a perfect test, but it's about all there is, in addition to kind of a digital rectal exam, which was the other part of a typical screening. But they just said men shouldn't be getting it. And previously, the recommendation had been that men over the age of 50 consider, you know, a lot of doctors would have you come in annually for the PSA test and the digital rectal exam. And they just said, no, it doesn't work out. They were looking at huge studies that basically allowed them to trade off, in their minds, the number of overtreatments and overdiagnoses, as they put it, and the huge number of people that would suffer terrible side effects from being treated who probably didn't need to be treated in their minds for a disease that typically doesn't kill. It progresses very slowly, develops in most men very late in life, and you're likely to usually die of something else, even if you do have it. In black men, though, the disease is often more aggressive and often caught later. And one thing the screening recommendations included was down in the fine print, the task force said that it really didn't have significant data on black men. They don't come in to be studied by, you know, for the reasons we just discussed. And also one of the studies, I think, was in Scandinavia that they used. There just weren't significant black numbers of black men used in the data. And there isn't to this day, there isn't data to support one way or the other whether black men should be screened, firm data.
So even if you have better screening tests, then there is still the question of outreach and overcoming the various barriers, access and cultural and historic reluctance to access the medical system. Are there places where outreach is better, where African-American men are screened more frequently and have a lower incidence and certainly a lower mortality rate?
There are a number of kind of novel ways to do outreach. And what typically I think public health folks look at in some communities for the channels they use to push information out to black men, they'll look at churches and they'll look at barbershops, of all things. You know, black barbershops. Where are the men going to be? Who are they going to listen to? And they'll do things like train up barbers as lay health advisors. They'll give them information and teach them how to spread it in a way that's useful, practical. Of course, the screening recommendations made things savagely more complicated when you're trying to train a lay person. I think some medical professionals kind of struggle with explaining this. And so in many parts of the country, there are barbershop efforts. One issue with those over the years has been sustainability. A lot of times you'll have a researcher come in and start one of these things up. They'll run it for a couple of years off a grant and then disappear. It's one of those things like a garden. It needs to be tended constantly to make it work. But you do have sustainable versions of it here, there, and yon. And there are also plenty of efforts, and we've seen that here, to go through churches. The ministers are often viewed as leaders in the black community, and they're trusted, and they can often persuade men that it's a good idea to come in and get regular health care.
North Carolina as a state, what is it doing and what could it do to be more creative, I guess, in screening and outreach?
Well, it's got a blueprint that's fairly new. It's only a couple years old for attacking cancer, particularly the ones that are seen as the big targets. Won't say low-hanging fruit. None of it's easy. But that plan is not substantially funded. The state paid to create the plan, but, you know, actually getting things done can be pretty expensive. And there just isn't additional funding for that. You know, when you talk to state leaders, it's not really, really high on their agenda. They want to work with partners that are out in the field and, you know, try to get by with what they can do with kind of leveraging manpower with various other organizations. But there are programs, there are state programs elsewhere that kind of piggyback on models used for breast cancer screening. That are, you know, that give state funding for impoverished black men to be screened. It's not a widespread thing, but it's used in a couple of states. That's one thing. There are, of course, those outreach programs. A little bit of money. One public health expert out in the eastern part of the state told me, Jerry Parks, longstanding expert in public health in the eastern part of the state, he said it wouldn't take much. Just a little bit of money goes a long way with outreach stuff, as opposed to treatment and dealing with cancer once somebody's got it, which can be really, really expensive.
We'll take a closer look at outreach efforts and some of the research that's being done. First, I want to thank Jay Price. He's a reporter for WUNC and a former correspondent with the News and Observer. His series, The Silent Killer, is part of the News and Observer's series. You can see it at their website. You can also find links to it at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to continue to explore the topic of prostate cancer with a survivor and some of the professionals who are fighting it. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things from broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today talking about prostate cancer and how it affects men in African-American communities in North Carolina. Joining us to talk about the science of this disparity and an outreach program that aims to close some of the gaps in the disparity, Stephen Paterno is deputy director of Duke's Cancer Institute. Nadine Barrett is director of health equity at Duke's Cancer Institute. And Stephen, I want to welcome you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Nadine, good to have you here as well.
Thanks for having us here as well. Thank you.
So, Stephen Paterno, tell us what we know, how you became interested in this, and what's the genetic piece that in this whole story of this disparity now that we see in both incidence and mortality among African Americans with prostate cancer?
Well, I guess the first part of your question is how I got interested in it. I am a long-standing researcher in cancer, looking at the molecular and genetic biology of cancer. I spent many years in Washington, D.C., where there is a very significant African-American community at a very high risk for prostate cancer. So I grew interested in that problem as a former cancer center director in Washington, D.C., went at that problem from two different directions. Earlier, you talked about the community-based aspect of it and the social determinants of health and access to care, which is always the most important issue whenever we talk about health disparities. And so we launched a number of programs to address that in D.C., which you'll hear from Dr. Barrett in a minute, we're doing here in North Carolina as well. But I wanted to also get at this question that you referred to earlier about why African-American men present to us at an earlier age with more aggressive disease and that their mortality rates are higher even when access to care issues are taken care of and flattened or normalized, as we would say in science. So we began a study that was funded by the National Cancer Institute to try to determine whether there were any biological contributions to this more aggressive disease that seemed to be more prevalent in African-American men. I want to hasten to say here something that's very important because we can get into some difficult and sometimes controversial issues here. Race in and of itself is not a biological or a genetic construct per se. Race is a sociocultural construct. But regardless of your worldview, whether religious or secular, biologically, we are all out of Africa, and it is only a matter of when and in which direction our ancestors left Africa. as that diaspora occurred across the planet, genetic heterogeneity began to develop because our lifestyles of our ancestors were changing as we spread across the planet. And what that did is end up creating genetic heterogeneity that makes some ethnicities, some races, even though they're only a sociocultural construct, more susceptible to certain diseases. Within cancer, that can go in many directions. It's not only a one-directional disparity. There are other cancers that are predominantly seen only in Caucasians. So back to the study, I began a study trying to understand whether there was a biological contribution to the disparity, and we started comparing the genomics of prostate cancer disparities in African-American men, comparing it to Caucasian men, as a natural experiment, so to speak, of comparing high-risk individuals with more intermediate-risk individuals. And based on that study, which is now taking place here at Duke, funded both by the National Cancer Institute and the Department of Defense Prostate Cancer Research Program, we have identified a number of genes that drive the aggressiveness of prostate cancer. Using the difference between whites and blacks allowed us to find what those genes are. But once we knew what the genes were, we went back and looked at aggressive prostate cancer in any race, and those genes are the ones that drive the aggressiveness regardless of race.
So that would explain certainly the higher mortality rate. What about the higher incidence? Is that related to the same findings?
The higher incidence rate is actually a little bit more complicated because that's where the sociocultural differences can come into play. So lifestyle differences, smoking, diet, exercise, other potential risky behaviors can be more prevalent in certain communities and can contribute to higher risk.
Well, Nadine Barrett, you are running an outreach program. It is your job to get the word out. Tell us how you make connections now. What are some of the means that you use to get this story out?
That's a great question. And what we do find is that nothing, because it is so complex, that it requires a multi-pronged approach, if you will, to being able to address prostate cancer, and particularly as it relates to education and awareness. I will add also that as much as we can educate a community and raise awareness, those things are very important. But if people do not have access to be able to act upon that education and awareness, we've really done nothing except educated and given a raise awareness. And so it's really important that not only do we give the information, but we also provide those resources that people can get the screenings when they need to get it. That being said, one of the things that we do, and several things that we do actually within the Duke Cancer Institute and through the office, is one, we have patient navigations, which Steve Paterno just referred to. Outreach and screening navigators, they actually go out into the community and identify people who need access to care and who actually specifically need access to cancer screenings. We also go to different events through churches. We have an ambassador program where we actually work with health ministries in developing health ministries and then addressing not just the specific screening piece, but also some of the things that Dr. Paterno just referred to, such as thinking about smoking, thinking about exercise and nutrition and all these other factors that could actually be preventive mechanisms as well. And so we most certainly work on that effort. We also partner and collaborate with the community to be able to identify what the community has identified and what they specifically say is meet us where we are. Don't create things that make it difficult for the community to get to somewhere or have to come to Duke, et cetera, but really going where the community is. So, for example, again, churches is a big part. Barbershops are certainly a big piece of that as well. We also reach out to some of our navigators actually engage with beauty salons. We also speak with women because, as we oftentimes know, that men will engage with the healthcare system at the prompting of the women in their lives. And so most certainly being able to engage in that has been a very effective method. And essentially, our patient navigators identify people, eliminate the barriers that are stopping them from getting the screening that they need. Once those barriers are eliminated, they ensure that that person gets screened. If that person is screened and there's a challenge, we have treatment navigators who's actually a nurse who can then take that person and move forward. The other big thing that we do actually is a mass screening event, which is our Men's Health Initiative. This is something that has been a big part of the Duke history for several, many years now, almost 20 years, and it was led by many of the great urologists, et cetera, that's at Duke. But it's also a partnership with Lincoln Community Health Center, and I think it's really important to be able to have this partnership, if you will, with an academic institution and a local health center. Essentially, it's a two-day event in which on Saturday from 8 to 12, we open the doors at Lincoln and provide free prostate cancer screening, which includes the digital rectal exam and the PSA. And then we move to the next step. The next day, we also provide the same services at Duke from 12 to 4. So we open the Duke Clinic and provide that. We reach over just 2 days in an 8-hour period, over 320 men that come in and get their screenings. We recently added an extra component, which has been really critical, is informed decision making. So again, we raise awareness, we educate, but we also make sure that men can make an informed decision with a provider of what is best for them and then going for the appropriate screenings that they need. Oftentimes, there's a lot of controversy, and there has been controversy about community screenings, and we find that most certainly, I mean, if you ever get to attend one of those events, it's amazing how many men year after year have been coming, and now some of these men are actually bringing their sons, and some of their sons are bringing others as well.
Controversy about the effectiveness, whether people show up, is that that's where the controversy is. You can offer these things, but people don't go.
Well, it's that, but it's really more about, and would you actually, I'll let Steve take that, would you?
Well, Frank, just addressing that controversy, mm-hmm. The pendulum tends to swing to extremes, and it is swinging back to the middle now, and I think that's a great thing. And the reason is the studies that were looked at a few years ago created the controversy when the announcement came out.
Oh, this is over PSA testing.
Over PSA testing, mm-hmm. that we should not be screening. Those studies were following men over a time frame that was typical of cancers like breast and colorectal cancer, without recognizing that, generally speaking, prostate cancer is a slow-growing cancer. Those same studies are now being reanalyzed, and these data are now coming out in high-level journals and being presented around the country and around the world. As you reanalyze those studies following men at 9, 10, 11 years after screening, the curves are bifurcating dramatically now in favor of screening.
Well, I know the churches have come up a number of times as a locus, a place to find men. And the Reverend Thomas Walker of Ebenezer Missionary Baptist Church is a place who spends some time in churches in Rocky Mount. In particular, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. He was treated and is now cancer-free today. Reverend Walker is now an advocate for prostate cancer testing in African-American communities and joins us now. Reverend Walker, good to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Good to be here. And I might say I could just sit here and listen to your other two guests. they're really encouraging in the light of all of the confusion we have around this issue now. But the fact that they're putting out their approach is the most positive I've heard as I move across the country over the last maybe 8 or 9 years. It seemed like the urologists and the researchers are just battling against each other, and that the insurance companies is manipulating the whole process.
Well, tell us your story. Why did you decide to get tested in the first place?
Well, when I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, I had at that point a wife who had a neurological condition herself, and our focus was pretty much on her. But I had what I don't recommend men look for. I had some symptoms at that point. We recommend people just go and be tested at 40, but I had some obvious symptoms of slow urine and getting up through the night and stop and go. And my wife used to joke at me and said, "You're paying so much attention to me, you need to go get yourself checked, you know." And she continued to say that, saying things like, when I go to the restroom before her, you let me go first because you don't know what you want to do and all that. Mm-hmm. It just became a joke. Mm-hmm. But once I went to see the urologist, he too was very positive. Even though I was showing the signs, I was had over 4 point PSA. And he said, we're going to get it checked, but we don't think we'll find anything. I guess not all the time you might, because I was 5.4 at that point. Mm-hmm. And when it did, it came back positive.
Was there any reluctance on your part? I mean, apart from the fact that you were preoccupied, your wife's condition in your mind was more important, but any other reluctance that you personally had? And then I'd ask you, too, about the men you talk with when you try to encourage them to go. What are they telling you if they're putting up some resistance? Why are they telling you they don't want to be tested or treated?
Well, my reluctance was just multiplicity. It was just a lot because of my profession. I'm a pastor, and I was an elected politician, and I had a sick wife, and da-da-da-da. But I found in general that men just don't like to go to the doctor, in particular when it's dealing with their prostate, which most of them call prostrate. And we had to kind of struggle around that for a while. And because it's perceived, and it is, a sex organ, and there's a lot of barbershop talk that's not founded around it. And so it's just difficult. Your point about the women, I think, is critical. In fact, as I do workshops around the country, I insist that women are there because men are very slow about going to the doctor for anything. Mm-hmm. In particular, that. So the reluctancy I found was they want to know questions like, you know, if you have prostate cancer, what effect would it have upon me sexually? Mm-hmm. That's a primary question. They want to sit and talk about that. What's the potential of death and suffering, et cetera? So you have to go through all that process.
So, Nadine Baird, you talked about first access. You have to, you know, you want quick treatment, so there needs to be something nearby. You solve that problem. You open up screenings. You make it available. But what about some of these deeper questions that would keep people from accessing the access you provide and the screening that you open up? You know, you heard, I think, Reverend Walker talk about some of the approaches he's taken. Generally, how do you approach those questions?
Oh, that's a great question, and I most certainly agree. I think one of the challenges is that the fear that people have about getting the prostate exam, and particularly, I'll call it what it is, a digital rectal exam. I think that no one would find that necessarily that pleasant. It doesn't even sound pleasant, quite frankly. And so I think that that's one of the biggest challenges that we hear. And so what we typically do is liken it to a vaccine shot. No one likes to get vaccinated. No one wants to get a needle in their arm. But yet you get a small piece of discomfort that could actually save your life. And so that is part of a big part of what our staff and all of us at the office talk about within the community, is really helping people to realize that this is something that could save your life. It's something that could also allow you to be there for your loved ones. So that's one particular piece. I think the other part, however, is also just really helping people to know when they should get screened. I think that oftentimes people know that there's this prostate cancer screening that one should get, but they don't know when it should be. They don't know if it's something that they should even consider, if it's something that they're concerned about. And in fact, some people aren't even aware of exactly where the prostate is. And so I think that all of these factors, again, speaks back to the importance of outreach and education, making sure that we also create opportunities. So, for example, we have one of our reverends, Reverend Davis, who actually on a Sunday after service brings his men together, have a conversation, and then they all come and get screened. And so really speaking to leaders such as Reverend Walker and others who could really be able to help make a difference in helping men realize that this is something that is part of your health care. And I think there was a point that was mentioned earlier as well, Reverend Walker mentioned it, is that typically men do not engage with the healthcare system in general. And so the idea of having to engage with the healthcare system always becomes a concern or a challenge, or even there's other priorities, competing priorities. And so really helping men to realize that this is equally important for them.
But also it seems to me that some training can go in the air. We've talked only so far about what we can do with African-American men, outreach and training there, but it sounds like the medical community itself and the research community Absolutely. Could also use a little bit of training, right?
Absolutely. And that is a big part of what we do as well within the Duke Cancer Institute, is we really look at it, as a multi-pronged approach. Because there are issues of trust and trust of the medical establishment, there certainly are some challenges in terms of being able to help the community to engage. So we're doing all this education, to your point, that's helping people to feel more comfortable and feeling that there are some outlets and mechanisms that we put in place within the system to be able to help that. But when they come and actually engage with the system, we need to make sure that our providers are at the point in which they can also provide that care that we are promising that they can get by through our outreach activities. So we do several types of trainings, opportunities, both one-on-one within research teams and groups, and also larger within some of our faculty and staff about bias, about knowing what the challenges are and how to be able to communicate effectively with our patients, and also being able to be mindful of what are the things that people in the community who are engaging with the system, what are the things that may be impacting their perception as they come and engage with the system, and being able to be mindful of that and effective in communicating at every level.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Dr. Nadine Barrett is Director of Health Equity at Duke's Cancer Institute. Stephen Paterno is Deputy Director of the Duke Cancer Institute. And Reverend Thomas Walker is the author of Brother to Brother, You Don't Have to Die with Prostate Cancer. He's a pastor at Ebenezer Missionary Baptist Church in Rocky Mount. Thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find out more about prostate cancer at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a new look at Harry Golden and his take on Jewish life and culture in the South. You'll hear it on The State of Things. Please stay tuned.